All right, so I'm going to give you here what I think is, pretty good, like, summation of all the stuff that we're looking at in Mussolini and in Hitler, and a little bit even pointing towards the next section, which is about nationalism. I guess the starting point there is to recognize that this week, in looking first at fascism and then at nationalism, we are, in effect, looking at one central phenomenon, which is the nation state and the will to the nation state, the building of nation states. And there are certain questions about nation states and their inherent tendencies which get raised by this discourse on fascism. So we're looking at the nation state, which would be typically understood as a sort of two-part assemblage. The United States is a nation state, meaning that it has a population, a nation, which in some fashions or other is uniform, is understandable as a single people with a single culture and even a single language. And if you start looking at those things carefully, you'll start to recognize even the notion of the nation state is itself a problem, and it starts to look fascist. If we push the essential attributes of the nation state, we're likely to find fascism. Now, I have to admit that I am influenced by Pierre Clastres and then Abdullah Öcalan, who will be the last person we read for nationalism. Both of those writers feel and assert that fascism is the essence of the state. You want to understand what the state is, you can look at fascism and look at the notions of fascism, and you will be identifying the essential markers of all nation states. So, of course, that's an evaluation made from, specifically a democratic confederalist perspective, but a sort of anarchist perspective, because it looks at state formations in general as problematic. So we're looking today at the state, and fascism as a particular insistence upon and relationship to the state. And in passing, maybe we are already thinking about states within states, because that's how Hitler identifies the Jewish community, which is not the word that he would use, Jewish conspiracy, Jewish, all kinds of nasty stuff. He thinks of Jews as composing states within states. And when we move on to Leroy Jones, under the heading of nationalism, we'll then be talking about nations within nations. Black people in the United States, Jewish people in Germany, form a kind of nation within a nation. That is, they have an identity, they have a shared language, they have a shared culture, they might have shared interests, but those interests are somehow or other distinct from, maybe even opposed to, the interests of the dominant nation and the population that understands itself as such a nation. Okay, now let's think for a moment about fascism as ideology. We need to recognize that clearly what Mussolini and Hitler are offering here are forms of ideology. But we also need to remember our principles about ideology, which is that ideology never truly exists just by itself. It's not just that different people have different opinions. That's not what's really going on, especially when we see a particular ideology become so prominent that it's going to be included in textbooks like ours. It's not just they had some opinions. They were involved in certain practices, and this ideology exists in a permanent, although perhaps varying, relationship with certain practices. So to begin with, this is sort of similar to what we found in Hayek. We can see that fascism is here defined in what we might call dialectical or differential juxtaposition with other ideologies. And the specific ideologies that are referenced in both Mussolini and Hitler, and that reference is used in order to distinguish and to identify just what fascism is, are democracy, parliamentarian, democratic thinking, liberalism, The notion that the government is established by the population, it's just put there in order to facilitate the action and rights of individuals, which secretly means the action and rights of property owners, that liberalist or liberal position, and then most importantly, Marxism and socialism. So fascism is defining itself against, fascism as an ideology is defining itself against these other ideologies. But then if you look carefully at the actual historical circumstances in which these fascist doctrines are advanced, then you will find that it's not just at the ideological level that these oppositions were happening. It's also on the street. So, of course, the Nazis and Mussolini both replace parliamentary democracies with their own fascist organizations. And, of course, in the run-up to their ascendancy to the establishment of fascist states in Germany and in Italy, there are street battles as well as parliamentary battles and ideological battles and propaganda battles specifically with Marxist factions. And the reason that the Marxists are the fundamental antagonist is that the Marxists, the socialists, the unionists, the anarchists are all vying for control over, or at least organizing orientation of, the working class population. And it is also the working class population that the fascists want to organize. So they have to attack their primary enemy on the streets in order to get control over the bodies in the streets. And the ideological way this appears, of course, is that Marxism is a part of a Jewish conspiracy, because so many prominent Marxists were Jewish, including Marx himself. And then lastly, I think we also have to see the ideology and the recommendations within this writing as having a tool use. It's propaganda, definitely, but it's also ideology in a more applied sense. It's a guidebook. It's a guidebook for organizing the psychology and the behavior of individual potential fascists. It's a guidebook for how to organize groups of people. And it's a guidebook for the kind of action that should be taken within the fascist movement itself. So in all these ways, this doctrine is not just a doctrine. It's the representational, linguistic, public propaganda dimension of a real struggle for organization, control, and direction of the masses. And of course, it's a struggle that in both cases is for a period of time won by these fascists. The fascists defeat Mussolini and Hitler, the Italian fascists and the Nazis. They do destroy the Marxist capacity to organize, and they do imprison those political prisoners, and they do organize German and Italian society along rigid hierarchical fascist lines. Okay, so before going on to talk more about what constitutes fascism in that sense, what is fascism as an organization of society, I want to point out that there are some very strong ideological influences going on with these fascist writers, especially Hegel. Hegel, and I would say in the background, something like Plato, but that's more general. But Hegel is front and center. So just remember this as a basic principle about ideology. New ideologies, I mean, you know, the symbol of fascism, the fascis, that's an ancient Roman symbol, if not earlier. But there was not a discourse about fascism until the 20th century. It's a new political ideology, if you like. But it's not built out of nothing. It comes from pre-existing ideology. And when I read this stuff, I hear Hegel. I hear Hegel all over the place. Which is a little bit funny, because Marx is also coming from Hegel, right? And the whole 20th century Frankfurt School style opposition The critical theory opposition to fascism is also rooted in Hegel. But there's a particular selection in both cases. Here, the selection that is made from Hegel is choosing Hegel's, I would call it, warlike and state-worshipping tendencies. Hegel, first of all, claims, and I don't know that Marx really disagrees with this, that the individual only ever achieves something that could be called freedom by obtaining a place of duty, a role that they have to play within a social totality. The individual only becomes the individual, has its identity as an individual, its value as an individual, insofar as it finds its place within a certain totality and does its duty at that position. That's Hegel, and that's our fascists. He's got really pushy ideas, Hegel does, about the state. He even goes so far as to say something like, you know, the history of the state is the footsteps of God in history, or that the state is the idea of God as it appears on earth. That's definitely part of how Mussolini and Hitler and Mazzini, who's our first nationalist, that's how they all talk. And this is part of Uchelon's critique, too, is that the nation-state is always fundamentally religious in this way. It's primarily that the notion of God gets replaced by the notion of the state in a fascist arrangement, but in general in the nation-state, because remember the hypothesis here is that fascism lays out for us the essence of the nation-state. And then further things from Hegel, especially Hegel's master-slave dialectic, which will become important for people like Franz Fanon, too, who was a big reader of Hegel. The master-slave dialectic in Hegel is this theoretical battle to the death between individuals, or could be between cultures or classes, depending on who's reading the passage. This is from The Phenomenology of Spirit, about a third of the way in. But the way it's taken on an individualistic level is that if a man really wants to be a man, that man has to be willing to face death. And in the struggle unto death, the weak lose, and they lose because they cling to the body, they cling to life, they cling to their material needs, and therefore they are shown to be weaker, less spiritual, more material, and in this struggle it is the one which is spiritual above the body, to the point of being willing to sacrifice the body, who ends up as the master, and justifiably so. Although, of course, this unfolds further in Hegel, where the slave ends up in a tighter relationship with matter and therefore in a position of power over the master, and blah, blah, blah. That's not showing up in these fascists. But that basic idea that a man is one who is willing to risk life or to sacrifice life for spirit and for the whole and for this abstract notion of the people, which is pretty much identified with God, that's coming from Hegel. And then deeper in the philosophical background, and I think this is important to recognize too, since it shows how deeply fascism is connected with the entirety of the Western tradition, there's this connection with Plato and with Christianity. This is classic idealism, which involves a kind of dualism between spirit and matter. You know, the idea that ideas or spirit on the one hand are distinct from matter, and that the good man and the good society, you know, the good man on the one hand is the one whose mind controls his body. He's in control of his passions. And this is all about, this is super gendered. It's all about men. And then on a larger scale, the good ruler, this is still Plato really, is the one who is guided entirely by spirit and thought. And that is what qualifies that individual as the one who can direct the rest of the society. Plato also thought that the majority of people were tied to material goods and pleasures, and that they therefore were unable to see clearly. They were not interested in seeing clearly, and therefore they needed to be controlled and organized from above by someone who was exceptional. And that exceptional individual is always a minority, and maybe even a certain individual. You know, like it, I think it really can be the case that Mussolini and Hitler think of themselves sort of like philosopher kings, although they're much more macho than the philosopher king because they're more committed to aggression, expansion, violence, and domination. They're practical in this respect, right? Or even praxical. There's this idea that you have a spiritual idea, and then you apply that thing, that idea, according to the spatio-temporal circumstances where you find yourself. But you're always becoming more spiritual, more ideational. And this always points back at the need to sacrifice the individual to the whole. So this is coming from Western philosophy. You can find it in Plato. You can find some of this stuff in Descartes. You can definitely find it in Christianity. But not just in Christianity, and you know, certain interpretations of Judaism, and definitely in good chunks of Islam. This Western, monotheistic, dualistic, idealistic tradition is one of the underpinnings of fascism. Okay. So remember, the idea is that fascism is the essence of the state. If you look at fascism, you're going to find what makes the state be the state, or more broadly, what makes the nation state be the nation state. Now, I think we can look at this in two respects, especially looking at Mussolini, but maybe especially Hitler. They both have these two stages in mind, I think. One, you can look at the thrust of fascism as like an organizing effort, something that is coming into being, and it's always coming into being. It's always getting more and more fascistic. It is fanatical, as they both say. So fascism's central thrust, what makes it be what it is as something coming into being, is an aiming at state formation. That's the first thing we need to look at, as this process of state formation. You know, if you look at Hitler, it's the state-forming virtues are the ones that are going to be respected within a fascist man, a fascist youth, a fascist population. Those are the good people, the ones who have state-forming virtues, heroic virtues. And these all, Hitler says, are reducible down to the will of the individual to sacrifice themselves for the whole. But then you can also talk about fascism's ideal. It's telos. That's, you know, Hegelian or Aristotelian word for a final cause or a goal. What is it that fascism is aiming at? And in that case, we'll be describing the state form. First of all, you know, what is fascism as an organization of a population under a state? And then more broadly, what is fascism as a tendency with respect to other states? Fascism is inherently expansionistic and imperial. And these guys, you don't have to deduce that. These guys tell us that. Okay, so fascism as the will to state building and as the practice of state building. This is recommendations about how to do fascism. So at the most practical level, what does this mean? It has to do with gathering up male workers and aiming them against the Marxists and giving them an ideology in Germany about the Jews. And in each case, an ideology about the centrality, the importance, the homogeneity, the greatness of some people. And of course, this people has to be an abstraction, right? Because it's going to disallow a lot of the people who are actually present within a particular territory, specifically the Jews in Germany. The Jews are not the people, even though they're there. So the people is imagined. The German people is imagined, but it's imagined violently, right? And it's violent imagination is not limited to thought. Its violence is that it's purely ideational. So the fascist German body, the German body politic, the Reich, can never be complete because the Reich is an idea which is perfect and unchanging, whereas the German population can only ever approximate that. So the violence is absolute. The violence is unending on the one hand, because the thing that is being built can never be achieved. But on the other hand, because the unachievable ideal is perpetually active, like a turbine or a cyclone within the German population. So what do you do in order to start fascist process towards this Reich building, towards this building of the people? You encourage certain ideas. You implant ideal values, specifically about heroism and the sacrifice of the individual for this alleged pure people. You encourage the practice of total commitment, fanaticism, especially in obedience and violence. So you have to develop heroic virtues and praise them. And you have to juxtapose those, contrast those heroic virtues with material interests. You know, low people are ones who are concerned with the well-being of themselves, first of all. That's pathetic. What a bunch of shopkeepers sort of way of thinking. What a Jewish way of thinking. But then also the broad Marxist concern about the well-being of the masses, which looks, you know, to these guys like a kind of pathetic excusing of the weak and consciencing of weakness within society. Those are signs of low character. You don't want anything to do with those things. You want to harden yourself, become hard. This is all about masculinity, and it's a particular vision of masculinity. Hard bodies with a maximum capacity for activity, where activity is understood primarily as meaning or as being best expressed in aggression. And this maximum aggressive, hard activity ultimately tends towards the sacrifice of the individual to the imagined heroic, homogeneous community, the country or the nation state. And notice, like, all the, this is fascism that I'm describing, right? But it's also patriotism within any nation state. And it's the ethos of soldiers, and maybe it's the ethos of police and so on. It's a macho ideal, but it's a fascist nation state ideal. And I say this just to clarify. I mean, I'm sure that you are hearing it anyway, but to, like, put it right out there, fascist tendencies exist within social formations that are not typically called fascist, and they definitely exist within the United States. Okay. Middle term, what are you building? If you've already got your hard young men rounded up, learning to value thoughtless obedience and maximum violence. Okay, now what are you going to do with this weapon you just built out of the young male population? You're going to aim at the construction, the realization of this ideal, which is the sameness of the nation. So this is specifically said in Mussolini. The state, this hardcore around certain brilliant leaders, these guys are not modest, that assemblage, ideas emanate with the leader or the leaders, and then they are executed by their committed, heroic young men. The society that they are aiming at, they do everything in the name of this true German society or true Italian society, but it doesn't exist yet. Maybe they think it used to exist. So there's a conservatism, kind of a selective conservatism probably involved here, but it doesn't objectively exist. They have to create it. What is it that they're creating? A centered nation with a single language, a single education, a normative racial type, a single culture where all other cultures and languages and races, even if they're in this particular territory, are codified as ethnic, less German, less American, etc. So if we step out and look back at Clastres and Uchelon, then we'll have to recognize again that the suppression of ethnic minorities is not an accident of the nation state. It's a part of the nation state. Okay, and then the long-term goal is the establishment of a fascist social organization. this first of all has to do with a relationship between leaders and masses. You want a rigid organization of the masses in hierarchies within a division of labor and still with class articulation, ideally way at the top with a single leader who has an iron spirit and will, and that leader is forming everything, right? If we were to get more fancy, and this is not apparent from this piece of reading. If I had given you a longer piece from Mussolini, it would become apparent. I tend to think that fascism is still, and Uchelon would think this, is still intrinsically connected with capitalism. Because though in the pure German or Italian fascist social formation, the capitalists don't have the total range of motion that they have within a bourgeois democracy, where effectively they are behind the scenes and the real ones pulling the strings. In the Reich, for example, they definitely have to defer more to the authoritarian militaristic state structure. But still, that state structure has a grounding in the exact conditions that are necessary for capitalist appropriation of value. Specifically, they're going to prevent unions. They're going to keep workers in line. They're going to have an iron discipline in production. And they're going to allow the continued, they will thus facilitate the continued accumulation of capital in the hands of some capitalists. So, I tend to be sympathetic to the claim that fascism is a form that capitalism takes when it is under attack or when it is about to fall apart. It's a defensive posture of capitalism. But that's not entirely obvious from this reading. Anyway, top down, right? Total top down control and totalitarian top down control, which again is a term that neither Mussolini nor Hitler shy from. Ideally, the will, the idea, the directions of the leader pass entirely into and through the mind and the body and the activity of everybody below. There is nothing that is supposed to be left over. You know, the state, which is centered upon the leader, becomes the soul of the soul of each individual. The deepest truth of the deepest truth of each individual is going to come from that state and that imagined but now forming homogeneous, masculine, violent, aggressive, and ultimately expansive society is coming into realization through the total submission of all bodies in this assemblage. And then more broadly, the health of the fascist state, and here's my question again, isn't this possibly true for all nation states, consists in expansion. Fascism is imperialistic. It understands the health of the homogeneous, racialized, whatever body, the body politic. It understands that to be expressed in ever-increasing aggressive activity. It's expansive, and it's territorially expansive. It takes over weaker neighbors. It takes over whatever it can get its hands on. The Italians take over Ethiopia. Why? Because they're the strong, and that's what the strong do. It's a law of nature. The predator descends upon the prey. The white fascist north depends upon the brown, weak south. This is a law of nature. You can't get away from it. If you're too weak to accept it, that just shows that you need to be dominated yourself. This is fascist reasoning. Okay, and then we can talk about the telos, you know, fascism as a structure. We're already there, I suppose. The few, the masculine, the active on the top, control and form and guide the many who are understood as feminine, passive, and weak. You have homogeneity of culture, language, religion, race, and then there are some methods of homogenization which appear at a propagandistic level but also extend into certain practices of this body politic. There's a perpetual logic of us versus them. You can see this being, you know, smacking in your face with Hitler, right? There's the Germans, and then there's the Jews. There's always the health of the nation on the one side and disease on the other. Health versus sickness is a primary rhetorical trope. There's a healthy body when it is ordered, working, homogenized, obedient, expansive. There is disease insofar as there's any heterogeneity, any interests at odds with the interests of this ever intensifying totality. If there are multiple races, if there's any kind of disobedience, if there's any kind of apathy or non-expansion, these are all codified as disease. And then, of course, what do you have to do with disease? You have to be a man about it. You have to cut that stuff away. You have to burn it. You need to aim at purity, right? Fascism is a fanatical will to a uniform body. And again, what if fascism is the essence of the state? What if the state is always aiming at homogeneity? And then moralism. You know, there's this whole thing that Hitler gives us about syphilis. It's an example of how to use propaganda, really. But it also exemplifies what were the central sorts of conservative tenets of German and Italian society. Sexual repression. Right, you can't just have like, you know, like any old sexual expression on the part of any old body. You know, Wilhelm Reich, who had firsthand experience, thought that sexual repression over moralism is central to fascism, and that the sexual energy of especially young men, which is repressed because they're supposed to be good Germans, is directed then into the eroticization of violence, rank, uniform, obedience, mass spectacle. And then the fascist structure, and if we were to believe Clastres and Uchelon, the nation state in itself is patriarchal. There's supposedly a natural family with a strong male who deserves, because of his strength, to reproduce, who is put together at a young age with a young, racially pure girl who has to obey him, of course, because that's supposedly natural for her. There's a eugenics dimension here that only the strong should reproduce. So you want to give the best women to the best men as prizes in order to advance the population. That's, you know, super Nazi. But that's also in Plato's Republic. The male is always considered active. The female is always considered passive. Marriage, here's like conservatism. There's an uncomfortable relationship between conservatism and fascism. Marriage is only supposed to be for procreation. And then I would say as a part of, also a part of patriarchy, there's a whole culture of violence. Manhood is defined, and it's defined as the best and as desirable, but it's also defined as focused aggression and the capacity to compel obedience. That's what manhood is. Okay, now I have a couple of closing points here. One, there's this stuff about propaganda, right? Hitler tells us propaganda is a weapon. It's a means to an end. And of course, so much of fascist practice has to do with the deploying of propaganda. You aim it at the masses, not the intellectuals. There's a real concern to think through how this stuff works, right? And if Hitler was not maybe the most brilliant man in other respects, he certainly was quite competent at the level of propaganda. And as he puts it, the art of persuasion, right? This seems to be his particular genius. You aim at the masses, not at the intellectuals. The intellectuals, he says, need quote-unquote scientific instruction, which you could understand as another dimension of ideology. But we're talking about mass propaganda here. You got to make it simple enough that even the dullest folks can understand it. You need to understand the emotional masses of ideas of the masses, as he puts it. You know, you have to know how to operate upon the emotions of the general population, and that's what you're aiming at. You're not aiming at understanding. You're aiming at feelings. And then notice there's also a strong rhetoric of dualism all through this stuff. There's us versus them, the Germans versus the Jews, the strong versus the weak, the heroic versus the hostile, the heroic versus the lying, honor versus poison. Like, things are really simple. And then I would just conclude by saying, you know, in addition to thinking through for yourself whether it might be correct that fascism is the essence of the nation state, clearly this stuff exists in some tighter relationship with our present. Now, this, I won't even get into the spread of fascist movements across Europe, but just remember that they exist. Let's just look at the United States for the moment, and in the moment. You know, so here's Trump talking about the Chinese virus, the foreign virus. We previously had Trump talking about the rapists and drug dealers from Mexico, people from shithole countries in Africa. There's this culture of violence, this masculine culture of violence and racist culture of violence at Trump rallies and within the racially centered, homogeneous, patriarchal culture of alt-right organizations that support Trump. And of the militias working with law enforcement. So there is a fascist dimension to the United States and specifically to this Trump moment. And then there's something about propaganda. You know, propaganda is absolutely central to fascism. And I think it's important to recognize that we now exist in the greatest concentration of propaganda ever to exist in the history of the world and perhaps in the history of the universe. No population in history has ever been submerged in so much image and message, so much of it aimed at the lowest common denominator, appealing to emotion, not thought, seeking to manipulate our actions on the basis of decisions made in some invisible stratum above us. This stuff matters now.